Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
We had more live sports last night. The UFC ran it back again in Jacksonville. So we had UFC Fight Night and the main event last night, Glover Teixeira and Anthony Smith. Let me start right there. That was something to see. You had a couple of guys who did their job, and then you had a few other guys who did not do their job. Glover sure as hell did his job. That was a monster performance. So before I get into the biggest issue of the fight, I want to make sure that Teixeira gets his due because he earned it. This dude is 40 years old. It was not that long ago that he lost 3 of 5 fights. It looked like he was coming to the end of a good career. Retirement, though, was a very real possibility. He has won 4 straight, and now you could have a conversation about whether or not he might get a look at the belt before he's done. This guy looked amazing last night and was in trouble early on, but looked amazing. And he went all Rocky Balboa with it after the fight, saying, quote, "It's not how hard you get hit. It's how hard you get hit and keep coming back."
It's not how hard you hit. It's how hard you get hit and keep coming forward. That's all about, baby.
This is such a good dude. That's what it's all about, baby. So he has looked tremendous of late. Possibly never better than of late. And he's 40. Similarly, it was 14 months ago that Anthony Smith was fighting John Jones for the lightweight belt. Smith is no tomato can. You know, maybe a late bloomer, but a very effective fighter, a dangerous fighter. And in the first round, Smith was giving Teixeira a lot of trouble. He looked great. He was popping his jab effectively, setting up his right, mixing in his kicks, generally having his way. It looked like it was going to be a long night for the older Teixeira. It looked like he was not going to be able to match Smith's athleticism, his length, his speed, his youth, his energy. And Smith came in with a focus and an intensity before that fight that I had never seen from him prior to getting into the cage. It looked like it was going to be a big night for him as he was landing the more significant blows in the first 2 rounds. But then in the third, things started to change. Things started to change, and by things, I mean Smith's face.
He's
You heard him.
You got to defend yourself if you're Smith. It was ruled a punch.
Yep. It looked like a punch.
Oh.
It looked like a punch by Teixeira.
Oh, my goodness.
Put Smith down face first.
A nasty, nasty 20 seconds from Teixeira. A brutal 20 seconds for Smith. And at that point, you might argue that a stoppage was possible. Now, you might also argue that if you stop that fight right then and there, it's premature. What you cannot argue, though, is that stopping the fight then would have prevented Smith from ultimately taking the worst beating ever. What you can't argue is that after that exchange, Smith was not going to win that fight. The phrase rearranging someone's face is not supposed to be a literal description of a guy's face. It's a figure of speech. Except in this case, Teixeira really was reconfiguring Smith's face. He was reconfiguring his head. Here's a quick recap of the damage. Smith told Ariel Helwani after the fight he suffered a broken nose, he suffered a broken orbital bone, and he lost a couple of teeth. And you know it's a brutal fight when you hear that list and your first reaction is that it? Is that all? Because it sure felt worse than that. Watching it, it looked worse than that. I mean, Teixeira beat the crap out of this guy. And that was as dominant and comprehensive a beating as you're ever going to see. If you were watching it last night, you may have seen Teixeira talking to Smith at one point during the fight. You might have wondered, what exactly is this guy saying to him as he's beating the hell out of him? But because there was no crowd, Mike's actually picked up the conversation. Try to make out what these two guys were saying to each other during the fight.
Teixeira saying he's giving up Glover.
Fighting at the plastic job.
What?
Fighting at the job.
Yeah, it is what it is, Mike.
Let me transcribe that for you. Teixeira said, "Sorry, Anthony, it's part of the job." Smith's response was, "What?" Teixeira said, "Sorry, part of the job," to which Smith said, "Yeah, it is what it is, bub."
Teixeira saying he's giving up Glover.
Sorry, Anthony, part of the job.
What?
Sorry, part of the job.
Yeah, it is what it is, bud.
I mean, that was so dominant that Teixeira was actually apologizing to Smith at one point. Like, "Hey, man, I'm sorry I'm beating the crap out of you. I really don't want to have to do this, but it's a job, you know?" And Smith is just rolling with it. That's the only time, quote, "it is what it is actually a good answer, because that was what it was. A brutal ass kicking that actually was part of the job. And Teixeira is such a classy pro that while administering it and knowing the damage he was doing, he was actually apologizing to the dude that he was administering that beating to.
It is what it is, buddy.
And Smith, warrior that he is, was saying it is what it is, man.
It is what it is, buddy.
It is what it is, but more to the point, it was a beating that should have never gone on as long as it did. Again, the fight could have been stopped in the third. Frankly, I'm still not sure how Smith even made it out of that round. It definitely should have been stopped in the fourth, during the fourth, or after the fourth, and there's no way that Smith should have been permitted to come out to take even more punishment in the fifth, because it was clear long before then that he could no longer defend himself and he could no longer hurt Teixeira. And don't get it twisted, nothing but immense respect for Smith and his toughness and his courage. He was never going to stop. He was never going to quit. But it should have never reached the fifth round, let alone another minute four, before it was stopped. Even Dana White was saying afterwards it was hard to watch.
"You know, us sitting on the outside, it was a little tough to watch. Cormier was flipping out.
That's Dana White. And Daniel Cormier, we're talking about. If Dana White said it was hard to watch, we're talking about a pretty brutal beating. If Daniel Cormier is flipping out, we're talking about something really bad happening. And they're right. And I'll get to this later on, but exactly where the hell was Smith's corner when their guy was getting beaten to a pulp? What were they watching? Because I'll tell you what I was watching. I was watching Teixeira punch Smith's ear right off his head. Seriously, that's not even an exaggeration or an exaggeration for effect. That was a legitimate concern for me. I thought there was a chance we were going to see Teixeira give Smith a Vincent Van Gogh. Like, dude, where is the rest of his ear? But forget about the ear for a minute. Let's talk about the teeth. Because there were two moments involving teeth that were pretty insane. There was that moment in the fourth round where Smith was on the ground with Teixeira on top of him, and Smith is reaching out for the ref. If you were watching, something seemed a little bit off. Teixeira is choking Smith, and Smith keeps reaching for the ref, but not like he's going to tap. So what's he doing? Then the ref seems to take something from him and put it in his pocket. And it turns out it was, wait for it, a tooth. He gave the ref one of his teeth. Like, "Yo, can you hold this for me? Just for a couple of minutes. I'll need it back later, but I've got my hands full right now, and I don't want to lose it." I mean, did that really happen? It did, because afterwards, Smith said that he found his tooth on the canvas, and he gave it to the ref. Dana White saw that whole thing transpire, and he couldn't believe what he was seeing.
"At one point, you know, I got monitors in front of me, and I said to my guys, I go, you know, Teixeira's punching him in the face, and he reaches out and handed something to the ref, and the ref put it in his pocket. I was like, what the f***? Did he just gave something to the ref, and the ref put it in his pocket? What could he possibly, he was picking up his teeth and giving his teeth to the referee, and the referee was putting them in his pocket. It was crazy. When he went back to his corner, all he kept telling his corner is, my teeth are falling out. So I didn't think he was coming out for the fifth."
That's an unbelievable soundbite from Dana. An unbelievable soundbite. I mean, not exactly somebody losing a finger and then having a medic put it on ice in the event that they can reattach it at a later time. But I've never seen a fighter lose a tooth and then hand it to the ref, and the ref puts it in his pocket like, "Yo, I got you. I got you, big dog." I wonder if the ref circled back after the fight and said, "Anthony, sorry about that busted beak and that broken orbital bone, but I do have your second premolar here for you, champ. And if that were the only mention of a tooth or teeth in that fight, I'd be fine. But of course it wasn't. Dana got into the other part. Like, I don't know. Maybe Glover thought that Smith's wisdom teeth were impacted and he was just going to extract them free of charge. I don't know. But as courageous as Smith was, and there is no disputing that, this dude was Lionheart. As courageous as he was, things were about to get even worse, much worse, which I'll get into in a few minutes. I mean, I got to hear that soundbite one more time, Alvin. Dana White saying, I'm watching, and I'm talking to my guys, and I'm looking on the monitor, and I'm like, what the hell is going on? He's trying to give the ref something, and the ref put it in his pocket? What? Push play.
You know, Teixeira's punching him in the face, and he reaches out and handed something to the ref, and the ref put it in his pocket. I was like, what the f***? He just gave something to the ref, and the ref put it in his pocket. What could he possibly, he was picking up his teeth and giving his teeth to the referee, and the referee was putting them in his pocket. It's crazy.
Live sports is back. UFC running back in Jacksonville. Hey, listen. This is not for everybody. Even Dana White said that was hard to watch. I tweeted as much last night between the fourth and fifth rounds, like, the guy just said, my teeth, I'm losing my teeth. That, I'll get into this later on, but that very clearly was a sign to his corner. Man, I've had enough. It's not my night. I'm losing teeth. But they sent him back out there, and it got worse. Jay Feely is my guest. First off, Jay, how are you and your family doing right now in the middle of this pandemic, Jay?
What's up there, Rome? We're doing all right. You know, Arizona has been surprisingly, it's been reserved out there. It hasn't been like New York, certainly, and it's been open. My son and I have delivered a bunch of meals. We started collecting money and going to stores, going to restaurants that were hurting, businesses that were hurting, buying the meals from them, bringing those to hospitals just to say thank you. And that was a cool little project that we did. My daughter, who's home from college, and if any parents are listening, whose kids are home from college, you know that they know everything, and you know nothing now that they're in college. Although I said to her, hey, if you know everything, why don't you take over the bills and pay for your phone and like take care of that stuff? If you're so much of an adult and you're on your own, and so it's a little bit of a transition period, but it's been good.
Jay, I'm laughing because I've got a son home from college as well, so I know exactly what you're talking about. In fact, right. You know, what you and the family are doing is great. The initial goal was $10,000, but you've blown right by that. You've gone by $20,000 as well. So what kind of emotions were you feeling when you were able to buy meals from local businesses to help them stay afloat and then deliver the food to the hospitals? And on top of that, you've got the whole family involved.
Well, I knew that it would help the restaurants. That was my main reason for doing it. I saw so many people who were hurting. The first restaurant we went to was in Scottsdale, and it was a restaurant. And I actually put it out on Twitter. I said, hey, if you're hurting, you're a restaurant, reach out to me because I want to come buy meals from you. And a general manager reached out to me. I went up there, and we bought 300 meals, and they were thrilled. Like, everybody there working was thrilled to have the orders. They had just opened in December. You know, you can imagine putting all that money, opening a restaurant, you open in December, and then 2 months later, everything shut down. Nobody even knows who you are, so they're not going to order from you, so you're just crushed. And to be able to just kind of go in and say thank you, to be able to go in and help a restaurant, and then the response from the doctors and nurses was fabulous, and that really surprised me. When you had doctors come down who've been working in the ER all day and tell you, hey, this has an impact. Like, it lifts the spirits of everybody here. You know, that made it worthwhile.
We're talking to Jay Feely. Jay, one more thing. You tweeted yesterday that your great-grandmother had taught you to play cribbage back in the day when you were just five. I bring this up because my father-in-law, who passed away not long ago, was huge on cribbage. Man made his own board, brought it with him everywhere, taught the grandkids. What is it about cribbage, of all things, that got you hooked?
Well, you know, it's kind of an old person's game. But I loved it. I loved going to the lake and playing with her, and she was no holds barred. Like, she was going to beat you. She was going to skunk you if she could, and you had to earn it. And I love to do that with my kids. You know, all the games we play, you know, I'm going to make them earn it if they beat me. And my family's been a card playing family. Like, my grandfather learned how to play hearts when he was in the war, and riding on the trains, and he taught his whole family. And we have a family reunion every summer. We play hearts. And you get points for where you finish every night. I mean, we're a competitive family now, Jim. When we when we have a tennis tournament, which we do every year, it's a couples tennis tournament, you get seeded, you know, and first seed goes with the last seed. There's a traveling trophy for the family every year. So whether it's cribbage or hearts or tennis, we like to compete.
Yeah, I'm not surprised hearing this at all. Jay Fiore is joining us. To that point, your son Jace is an elite kicking prospect at Gilbert Christian. What's it been like then to watch him grow as an athlete?
It's been fun. You know, it's so much harder as a father sitting on the sidelines than it is out there playing. When you have control, you have no control on the sidelines. And I wasn't sure that, you know, I wanted him to get into kicking. And he's a really good golfer. He's just a great athlete, and he wanted to kick. And as a freshman, he goes out in his second game, and he's got like a 50-yard field goal, and he knocks it through. And I'm like, oh, okay, this kid's got it. You know, there's a lot of people can go out and make field goals. Not a lot can go out and do it under the pressure. So when I've seen him come through in those clutch situations and play better in those situations, that's when you say, okay, he's got something inside of him that you can't teach. And it's just fun to watch. You know, he's bigger than I am. He's stronger than I am. He hits the ball further. He kicks it further. So it'll be fun to see where he goes.
He knows everything. Even if he's not in college yet, he knows everything because they all do.
Absolutely.
Jay Fiore joining us. Now, Jay, you've known Tom Brady for a long time now. What was your reaction when it became official that he was going to leave New England and head to Tampa Bay?
Jim, I had an inkling he was going to leave New England. This was going to be his last year, this past year. And, you know, my feeling is he's accomplished everything he could accomplish. He doesn't owe the Patriots organization or Bill Belichick or Robert Kraft or anybody, any of the fans, he doesn't owe them anything. He's given them everything he had. And if he wanted to leave and he wanted to try it somewhere else and he wanted to go find a little more enjoyment, then that was his right. He's earned that right. He was a free agent. And I was a little surprised he ended up in Tampa, you know, but I understand it with his family situation and wanted to be close to his son. And I think it's a good match with Bruce Arians. I really do. He's got better weapons there, Jim, than he's ever had in his career. Maybe the only other time he had receivers like that was when he was in New England with Randy Moss and Wes Welker in 2007 when they went undefeated. But he's got Gronk as well, and he's got other weapons on that offense. So they're going to be really good. Bruce is aggressive. He's down the field. He wants to have fun. It's a totally different dynamic than he had in New England. In New England, for 20 years, Bill Belichick used Tom Brady as an example and would crush Tom in meetings, you know, and point out every flaw. And people knew, well, if he does that to Tom Brady, what's he going to do to me? And so use that to scare everyone else. Bruce is the exact opposite. He will support his quarterback unequivocally. You know, when I was in Arizona with Carson Palmer's first year, he kind of struggled that first half of the season understanding Bruce's offense. He had Bruce's complete support, and Tom Brady will have that unequivocally. He'll have Bruce in his corner. He'll never say a bad word about him. So it's going to be a different experience, and I'm pretty excited to see how it goes.
Me too. Jay Fiore joining us. So in terms of his mindset, Jay, like, do you think that maybe Brady's going there because he wants to have a little bit of fun, he wants to enjoy himself, or do you think he's got like this kind of crazy rocket fuel and wild chip on his shoulder and he's on a mission still?
I don't think it's he does always have a chip on his shoulder, always. And anytime people doubt him and question him, he uses that as fuel and as motivation. And he'll certainly do that this year in Tampa. I don't think he has that chip, like, I need to prove myself outside of Belichick. That I don't believe exists. But I do think he wants to enjoy himself. At this point, when he's won 6 Super Bowls, and he's accomplished as much as he has, he's considered the best of all time. If you're going to keep playing after 40, why not go somewhere where you're going to enjoy it every day? I think that's the genesis of the change.
Jay Fiore joining us. Now, Jay, I know you've been watching The Last Dance as a competitor, as a strong competitor. What kind of thoughts do you have as you watch that series?
I just love it. I love everything about it. I love everything that Jordan did, the way he held guys accountable, the way he challenged them. You know, you mentioned, you know, coaching girls soccer at the beginning, coaching soccer, you know, with these high school girls, you try to hold them accountable. You try to push them like that. But, you know, sometimes girls are a little different than guys. You know, you're pushing them. One practice this year, I look over, I got like 3 girls crying, and I haven't even got on anybody in practice. I told our captains, I said, hey, go get a drink. You guys hug it out, get all the crying out, and then we'll start practice again. And I look over there 2 minutes later, and sure enough, every girl is over there crying. They're all hugging and crying, and I just kind of laughed to myself. I told our assistant coach, I said, we can't practice tomorrow on the field. We got to do something to build this team camaraderie. And girls are kind of like that. Now, I mean, a guy's locker room in a professional sport, it's a tough place. And you're going to have guys challenge you, and you're going to have guys that push against the system and don't listen to the coach. And when you have your best player, the best player in the world, who's the toughest on everybody, like Michael Jordan and Tom Brady, that's how you win and that's how you succeed. That's why I love it so much.
All right, Jay, you're hosting Chad Tough Live, Tougher Together Sunday from 7 to 9 Eastern. People who know the Michigan program know about Chad and Chad Tough. For those who do not know, who was Chad?
Chad is the legendary coach Lloyd Carr. It's his grandson. Jason Carr and Tammy Carr was their son, and he got DIPG, which is a rare pediatric brain cancer, and passed away from that, unfortunately. And as soon as he got it, Tammy and Jason started this foundation to try and get money to do research to find a cure, because there's no cure. When you get it, it's a life sentence. And unfortunately, one of my other teammates at Michigan, Jeff Delverne, his son Colt got it and passed away as well. So it's a foundation that is near and dear to all Michigan people, and they continue to fight to find a cure. And even though we're going through this, Jim, like this coronavirus right now, the families that are dealing with DIPG, they have to deal with that every day. It doesn't stop, and they know that their child faces a death sentence, and you're trying to find something, you're trying to find a cure, and that's why we're doing this. And so it's going to be a fun event. We're going to have Jason and Tammy will be on there. Lloyd Carr will be telling stories with me. John Beilein, the former Michigan basketball coach, will be on there. Chase Winovich from the Patriots. Dickie V will be on there telling stories. He'll be fired up. Mitch Album, the author. Mitch adopted a girl from Haiti, Chica. She ended up having DIPG and passing away from it as well. And so, most of the people on have a vested interest in trying to help this foundation and trying. They've raised over $6 million, which is just phenomenal for research. And it'll be a fun event, and it'll be a tearjerker as well. We'll have some families on that'll be talking about their children and what they're going through and what this disease does, and some of the doctors as well. So hopefully I can keep it together and bring us through it, but hopefully we have some fun and raise a lot of money as well.
You bet. Jay Fueling, my guest, really quickly. The original plan was for this to be a gala in Ann Arbor on Sunday, but that's not possible this year. So it's going to be an online event. Jay, really quickly, if people want more information on Chad Tough and the event, where should they go to get it?
Thanks, Jim. ChadTough.org. And you can click on the live button on Sunday, 7 to 9, right before you watch the last couple episodes of The Last Dance. You can get out and get your Michigan fix and listen to everybody and support this really worthy organization.
Once again, ChadTough.org. That's ChadTough.org, a 14-year vet, national champion at Michigan, and, of course, a college and NFL analyst for CBS Sports. Jay, I hope we can get together and do it in person soon. Great to have you on the show. Stay safe. And I know we'll talk again no matter what.
Thanks, Jim. Good to talk to you, buddy.
Yesterday, I profiled Leff in Laguna. Today, I'm going to the Midwest, and I'm going to give the treatment to the walrus, Caleb, in Green Bay. Unlike Leff, Caleb has not won a smack-off. Not yet. Keyword yet. Because for the last 3 years, this guy's been knocking on the door. I've been putting him right next to Terrence and Sierra Madre is one of the two best callers to never rip one. So to me, it may not be a matter of if, but a matter of when. Not a question of if, but a matter of when. Maybe. Hard to make that as long as Brad is still playing the game. Or hard to make that point as long as Brad is still playing. But that is the kind of game that this dude brings to it. And it's not like he just got good recently. This guy took a bat to the 12th man and every Seahawks honk way back in 2015 in a phone call that holds up even right now.
The smarmy, skinny jeans wearing beatniks and their girlfriends who look like they're auditioning for the inevitable Harry and the Hendersons remake. The people who chain smoke e-cigs at an Arcade Fire concert and then judge your lifestyle choices. The people who worship Chuck Palahniuk and watch Wes Anderson movies with their pants off. Jim, this is a fan base that forgot it even had a football team until the Sonics left. And now all they do is bitch about how much they miss the Sonics. Do you live in Seattle or Cleveland? And now they're going to roll out to the stadium on Sunday in their Subarus and their Fixies. They'll buy their Seahawks program so A, they can figure out which team is theirs, and B, learn the names and numbers so they can cheer when someone makes a score point or a goal basket.
It's strong. It's strong, and since that phone call, he's gotten even better. He's gone on to compete in the last five Smackoffs, and he's hit the board in every single one of them, and he's made it to the podium a couple of times, including last year when he ripped a very good third. And there is such a thing as a good third. He ripped a very good third, finishing behind only Brad and Rick, capping off his call with the very rare parody that actually worked.
Please rise and remove your cap for the singing of our national anthem.
Caleb in Green Bay, he's the man. Caleb in Green Bay's got great smack. Caleb in Green Bay says, I want to win the smack off, yeah. Caleb in Green Bay's a great, 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 great caller to the jungle.
One of the really creative things that he's pulled off in the jungle and at the smack off. In 2018, he made his smack off call as if it were 1995, talking about scuds and fish wraps and the fax machine and Extra Sports 690. He didn't break the theme even once. He also RSVP'd in 2017 as Buffalo Bill from the Silence of the Lambs. And Caleb is not just content to smack others around. He's got a penchant for making it artistic and nuanced. And that's a corner that he pretty much owns in the jungle. But that's not to say that he can't take a bat to others, because he can, and he has.
Vic and NyQuil, dude has the personality of a dial tone on Percocet. Now you're like the Dallas Cowboys. There's no doubt you have the talent, but you always turn out to be just average. You won a title years ago, but nobody is buying the tradition crap anymore.
SMH, stupid Mark in Hollywood. Hey, Beaks, bench the donut. Les, you can't go through life using other people's jokes and passing them as your own, okay? You might have some short-term success, but eventually everybody will figure out you're a fraud.
Yes, Mark, because you're having so much more sex than I am. The wife lets you hit it once every Boston World Series and only to procreate.
Can you imagine what would happen if one of these cadavers from the days of yore won the smack-off, like Carbone or the Cablanasian? They'd go longer in between titles than Rick and Buffalo when he can't afford a used car. Now, I'm not saying that high school teachers don't get paid very well, but I am saying that to save money on laundry, Rick just showers with his clothes on. He slams one Tide Pod over his melon, another one under his armpits, and a third in his mouth for a light snack.
And I've always wondered how Adam Hawk has a worse body than me. Bro, I'm walking around with a front porch that's more like a veranda, but you're the one in the chiropractor's office every couple days. You have the voice of a 20-year-old, the hair of a 60-year-old, and the spine of a 100-year-old. We can all see that Keith Arnold looks like Chael Sonnen let himself go, but I would never say that out loud. Caleb versus everybody. I don't want sympathy. I don't want a pity party. Take your best shot, tough guys. I'll see you in my driveway.
A couple of my buddies wanted to remind you of something.
Hey, Jim Rome. It's Randy and Jason Sklar. And you know what the smack-off is? It's a walrus game.
This guy's good. This guy's smart. Really smart. A couple of years back, you offered some advice to golden ticket holders that I wish I could play on repeat for the next 36 days because it's dead the hell on.
I have some advice for the golden ticket holders. Guys, you don't have to listen to me, but I was once where you are now. I did not hoard my golden ticket. I won mine in March of 2015. The smack off was late June. You have to keep getting reps. Don't wait for your opportunity like Jeff waits for the ambulance when he hits the life alert button. The reason Jim says just because you're in doesn't mean you're on is because the most calls Jim has taken in the last decade is 17 back in my rookie year. That sounds like a lot, but if you think about it, that number shrinks quickly. The legends are getting on. Recent champions are getting on. Guys like Jeff Passan, Benny in Wisco, Mark in Boston, myself are probably getting on. How many spots does that leave you? Three, maybe? Four, if you're lucky? Work your ass off before the event. Make yourself irresistible so that Jim has to take your call.
Extremely well said. And all of that is true. And every single person with a golden ticket right now should be treating that last sound clip like gospel, because it pretty much is. In an event that has been won by only Brad in Corona and Leff in Laguna for the past 5 years, it's easy to forget about somebody like Caleb in Green Bay. But coming into Smackoff 26 with a grip of Mo and a very good look at being the 15th guy to enter the Champions Club. There are only 14 members of that club, and you heard him say it himself, Caleb versus the world. And it really wouldn't be all that shocking if he got over on the world. 36 days until we find out. I can't wait.
Can't wait.
He is the most punctual person ever. We are joined right now by Bud Black. Bud, it is so good to have you back. First off, I understand you're in San Diego these days. So how are you and your family and everybody around you doing right now, Bud?
Jim, thanks for asking. Everybody's fine. Two daughters who are back from their journeys to college and work. They're back in San Diego. They're doing fine. Young granddaughter, 14-month-old, doing well. So the immediate Black family's fine, and those also connected with us as far as brothers, sisters, all that. Everybody's fine. So thanks for asking.
That's great, Bud. So what's it like really quickly? You've got a granddaughter now. What's it like being a grandfather?
Well, a little bit different than a father, but just as cool. I know that you're going through your experiences with your young kids now. Just wait. It gets better. It's really, really good stuff.
I love it. Bud Black is joining us. All right, Bud, so let me just jump right into this now. You've got reports this week of a proposal from the owners for an 82-game season with expanded playoffs, expanded rosters, as well as a few other details. Overall, what have you made of what you've heard of that proposal?
Well, you know, I've heard bits and pieces coming in over the last couple of weeks, and I know a great deal of thought has went into these proposals from the commissioner's office, and I'm sure input from, you know, a number of owners, executives, and even probably some player input to some extent. I think overall it looks good. I still think an 82-game season adds, you know, a great deal of integrity to a championship season. I think the expanded playoff is a good thing. I think we'll add excitement and interest in four more markets. The expanded rosters are a must, especially early, especially on the pitching side and even on the position player side. So, and beyond that, I think the extensive amount of testing and safety related issues are in place that I think everybody will feel comfortable with. So on balance, I think the big picture, broad perspective of the proposal looks very sound.
We're talking to Bud Black. Bud, you covered most of that. The one thing we have not mentioned, though, is the proposal aspect that has the DH to be used in the National League. What is your reaction to that idea?
Overall, Jim, I'm a traditionalist, especially as a National League manager. You know, our rosters aren't built with that one specific hitter in a lineup. You know, the Nelson Cruz, you know, the modern-day Nelson Cruz or David Ortiz or Edgar Martinez, where American League teams can go find that guy and assign him or develop him and have him right in the middle of our lineup. National League clubs, you know, don't build their teams that way. But with that said, you know, hopefully we can have a guy emerge and be a, you know, be a potent bat. The positive side, it gives, you know, our guys, our everyday players, a chance to get off their feet and keep them in the lineup. Arenado, Blackman, Story, you know, those guys are built to play every day, and you look at their track record of play, it's strong, they're durable, they play. So this gives them a little bit of a blow, too. So there's advantages, but again, I sort of look at it from a National League strategic side and roster building.
Rockies manager Bud Black joining us. You know, Bud, you know pitchers as well as anybody in the game. How much time do you think pitchers would need in a second spring training in order to get ready to pitch? And then how would you go about managing those pitchers once the season does get underway?
Well, I think, you know, the best case scenario would be 3 weeks, I think, to get you know, a pitching staff ready, and more importantly, the starters are the one you really you got to keep an eye on. The relief pitching core, I think, will be fine. Have no problem with a shortened spring. You know, the stamina and durability of a starter is what you worry about. It's going to be tough to build those guys up to, you know, 80 to 100 pitches in 3 weeks. But with the expanded pitching staff, you know, obviously you can handle, you know, the course of, you know, 8, 9, 10 games in a row. So you got to make sure that guys don't rush it. I know, I'm sure there's pitchers across the league, both American League clubs and National League clubs, you know, they're keeping in contact with their pitchers. Guys are continuing to throw, but they're not, you know, getting game action, game intensity pitches in. So it's going to be a little tricky at the start, but you really got to pay close attention when we get back to make sure they don't try to wrap them too soon. But The pitch count is going to be an issue as we start this thing.
We are talking to Bud Block. A lot of good information in this. You know, Bud, it's been interesting to see the UFC come back with a couple of events. Obviously, it's a totally different animal than Major League Baseball, but interesting to see what those fights have looked like without any fans in the arena. How different do you think it would be to be playing meaningful games without fans in the stadium and without having that energy to feed off of?
Yeah, it's going to be weird for the guys, and I think weird for everybody. I think players, at the core, they love competition, but they also love to entertain. I think guys at the big league level, like playing in front of fans, and the bigger the better, and the louder the better. I think guys really, really dig that. So with that, it's going to be weird. It really is for the guys. There's going to have to be an extra motor in there to keep the focus and keep the intensity. And that's something that we'll talk about, I'm sure, as a group and make sure that, that doesn't affect our play. But, there are players, the bigger the stage, the better. And it's going to be a little different for guys. I mean, we've all played in games that there's been rain delays where you come back every 2 or 3 hours. It's midnight and, the stadium's empty. Those bad weather games early in the year in certain markets, not many fans show up. So, I mean, there are games that, guys have played and competed in with, minimal fans. But from the get-go, wherever that might be, Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, Boston, San Francisco, I mean, our park, I mean, our fans are great. It's going to be weird, man. It's going to be weird for the guys.
Rockies manager Bud Black joining me for a few more moments. But I've been talking about The Last Dance on the show, and I do so because, as somebody who has worked through, and I'm about that same age group, I know that era pretty well, but to me it's so transcendent. I could talk to anybody in any sport, and they seem to have a take on this. I've got to get your thought as well, because I know you've seen it, and there is a baseball component, which we can get to in a moment, but overall, as one competitor watching another, what kind of thoughts do you have as you watch that, Doc?
I've watched all eight, Jim. I've watched them on Sunday night. Even though I've had them taped, I've watched them as they've come on. And like you said, I mean, I lived through the Jordan era. A couple things stand out to me. I didn't realize at the time that it took 5-6 years for the Bulls to really break through, and how Michael came in, and then it was a tough go for the Bulls. And then finally it happened for them. I'd heard the legend of his work ethic, of his practice sessions, his demands on his teammates. I didn't realize it was to the extent that it was. That's been informative for me, and it makes sense, right? I mean, I heard it, but to hear some of his teammates talk about it, I didn't realize it was to that extent. And just the physical and the emotional stamina that he had, to do what he did, practice hard, play hard, go play 18 holes of golf the next morning. The energy that this fella had, off the chart. And to see him, take a break, as he said, he was tired. I mean, it's understandable. So, I've been entertained for sure watching this. And, I met him one time, just real briefly in passing. And he's a little bit bigger, in person than he comes off on TV. It's amazing.
He's a specimen, to be sure. But one last thought. You and Terry Francona go way back. I know you didn't see him play live, but when you watch Jordan as a baseball player in the documentary, coming off a 14-year layoff and going right to double-A ball, how would you evaluate him?
Yeah, that's, that's the thing a lot of people forget about. Usually the path is you sign a contract, whether you're out of college or out of high school, and you go into rookie ball, you go into the A ball level where the competition's a little less, to go right into double A like he did and knock in 50 runs, steal some bags, hit over 200 against, a lot of those staffs have big league quality pitchers, right? Guys who are on the 40-man roster, guys who are prospects, and to hang in there, it's pretty impressive. And I agree with a number of the guys that, talked about it. If he would have got the reps, if he would have got, 1,500 at-bats, 3 years of full minor league play, all the reps he'd get in the cage and, his defensive work, I think he would have touched the big leagues. Now, I don't know how long he would have stayed, but he would have got there with his drive and his athleticism. So, that was sort of fun to watch. All right, with Tito – Tito said, Blackie, this guy, he was a player. He was a player. And I know that seeing Tito loved to golf. I know that, Tito had some great stories about him and Michael on the golf course.
God, but I got to say, not get too personal about it, but you and Tito are two of my favorite guys. Always have been so great to the show. What about Terry Francona? What makes him such a great manager? Guys would do anything for him. Guys love him. What sets him apart from others doing what he does?
You know, for me, you know, we were teammates, and, the first time I met him, I mean, there's a feeling with Tito of just, personable, honest, and just, what you see is what you get. And I think players love that. I think he's just got a nice way about him that, and he's able to connect with all different players. And he's got tremendous feel for humanity. He's got tremendous, people's skills are great. And that goes a long way. And obviously in our profession, I can't say enough good things about him. He played with energy and passion. And I think he does the same thing as a manager, man. I think the players feel as though he's right there with them all the time, regardless of his age and where he is now in his career, man. He's just a connector, man. He connects with people.
I know that if I were to ask him the same question about you, he would say the exact same thing. Colorado Rockies manager, 2010 NL Manager of the Year. He's entering his fourth season with the Rockies, and they have had nothing but success since he got there. Buddy Black, my guest. Bud, I appreciate you so much and the relationship. Great to have you on. Stay safe, and I hope we see some baseball soon.
You got it, Romy. Thanks, man. I was thinking today before I made the call that, we go back to, the late 80s at the mighty 690. I know we met first time at San Diego State on the baseball field there, and I'll always remember those early days of Jim Rome, man. Congratulations on everything.
Let's go to Toronto. Chris in Toronto. Good to have you, Chris. How are you?
Yo, what up, Jim? Hey, I went back and listened to that call from Allen yesterday, and he definitely said, I don't know what the heck he said. Listen, anyway, from Vancouver to Ottawa, you're welcome. From the 6 all the way over to the shiny up-and-coming dome of Rick and Buffalo, you're welcome as well. Listen, it's your boy Chris and the T-Dot and Matt in L.A. I know you heard what I just said, and you're rushing now to put down the plunger and pick up a line and come at me. And, Jim, I'm a little conflicted on this one. On one hand, please don't call. Jim, I know you love a good haiku, so Matt, here's how we feel when Jim announces that you're on hold. Looking at the phones, let's go to Matt in L.A. No! No! Dear God, no! That's 575 clones. But then on the other hand, on behalf of all the clones, please do call Matt, because there's nothing better than hearing the sound of a choppa. That is, unless Left is in it. Yo, Stalker, I know that those ears of yours heard Jim's mandate of no studio storming, and that also includes hopping back in the choppa to gimmick your way towards another title. Hey, Jim, nice rundown of Left yesterday with the caveat that he's not a gimmicky little bitch, and then playing his calls, which were full of gimmicks. You can't make this stuff up. We had a few minutes of gimmicks and the other parts of when he should have gotten run, so how is that not correct? What's next? Are you going to convince us that Silk isn't a narc or that Vic wasn't a one-call wonder? By the way, Alvy, when you get ready to do Vic's montage, make sure you always pull the calls from the day before the actual smack-off, since for whatever reason, that's when he does his best stuff. Jim, I called in the other day and I told you, I know it's smack-off season and folks are going to be coming for Canada. And wouldn't you know it, Dan in Denver called in and attacked my boy Matt and Van. Now listen, I know Matt can fight his own battles, but I went back to Stuckna to listen. And did someone who himself got run one year and then the next year come in eighth place, finishing above DA, who is probably still talking, and Mr. Wooden and Laconic himself, Jason Stewart, did that guy make fun of someone else's call? Bro, I went back and listened to your call, and I think Rome put you in eighth because he thought it was still Jay Stu talking. Rex in Albuquerque thinks you need to learn voice inflections. By the way, it's a good thing you like rap so much, since LT is the one you'll be hearing on Smack Off Day. Lastly, Jim, Tuesday marked the one-year anniversary when Kawhi touched every part of that rim. Mark in Hollywood, just mute me for a second, bro, and then come back because this isn't going to feel too good. But that kept us moving forward toward that eventual chip. And guess which city is still the beautiful city of NBA champions? That's right, haters. And I know some of you guys hate to hear it, but America's hat still owns your fat, balding asses, so pipe down there. And to the JTP, I know I kind of upset some of you guys with my last call. So, Jim, I'd really like to take this time out to apologize to absolutely nobody. If you don't like it, if you don't like what I'm saying, turn down your station. But to everyone else and to my Canadian brethren, let's keep doing this. Bella B, you own the ATP, and soon we'll be running this whole thing. The hate is loud. The love is louder. Let's do this together. War Team Canada, War Canadian Domination.
How about this? We now have ourselves, if I'm not mistaken, correct me if I'm wrong, have we ever had a Toronto entrant in the Smack-Off? I don't want to get too far ahead of myself. Hey, Nut, look that up. I'd ask James Kelly too, but Stucknut's got even deeper resources. I don't know if we have or we haven't, but we do have somebody now. Give him a golden ticket.
I've got a golden ticket. I've got a golden ticket.
So now you've got Matt in Vancouver, Lincoln, Nebraska. G off. What's up, G?
Geoff!
Go ahead, G off. You're on the air.
Put me out of my misery.
That's not a good call. No. You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
Geoff in SoCal. Geoff, what is it, dude? Like, do you really want to be in the field? Is that the play?
I got to be in it this year, my man. Hey, great call from Mark in Boston. I'm really looking forward to him carrying the Monday show like he did last year. Hey, Mark, enjoy being on hold for 3 hours come Smack Off Day. And great profile on Caleb. Jim, this guy is like Grandpa Joe in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. He sits on his fat ass in bed all year long, and then as soon as you come around with a prize, he hops out of bed and makes his tired phone call. But, Jim, the reason I'm calling, am I going to have to move to Saskatchewan? Because apparently all you have to do is get through a complete phone call as a Canadian to get in the Smack Off. Matt and Tyler have set the bar that low. Jim, what's the exchange rate for a golden ticket once it crosses the border? Is it frankincense ticket now? Maybe myrrh? And just like the Eagles stockpiling quarterbacks in case one gets the COVID, I'm assuming you're stockpiling Canadians in case Matt or Tyler go, well, you know, Matt or Tyler on Smack Off Day. And Jim, if you're looking for prize sponsors for the Smack Off, I have an inside source that there's a Huntington Beach that's business that's booming right about now during this global pandemic. And Jim, the reason I'm calling, I think it's only fitting to remind the clones that I had a golden ticket last year. And unfortunately, after a distasteful call regarding Kellen Winslow, an unnamed elderly woman in the Smack Off field, and an incident that was happening, I had my ticket revoked. So seeing as it is this time of the year again, I'd like to just apologize for some of my calls. I mean, in the words of Earl Thomas, this stuff happens, bruh. And finally, Jim, I want to congratulate Hawk on his new career as an influencer. His golf clothing line looks sick. I mean, what's next, Hawk? Are you going to start putting on booty shorts and slinging fit tee on Instagram? Hawk giving fashion advice is incredible, Jim. What's next? Is Alvy going to start pimping a contraception device? Is Rick going to partner up with a clean eating meal service? It doesn't make any sense. The only person who needs Hawk's clothing line is Cal in Vegas. Jim, that pic that popped up of him on Twitter the other day is phenomenal. Besides the obvious fact that Cal would need a step stool to rip off Connor's beard, his clothing is whack. Dude's got on a red Nike polo, a black Nike.
I can't believe you ran out of time. I'll give you my thoughts on that call on the other side. Stay tuned. We go to the OC. Reggie. Reggie, you're up. What's going on?
Romy, hey, I've been following this kook, Kyle in Green Bay, on his epic tour across the U.S. It's pretty well noted now. On the JTP for sure, as you just mentioned. By the way, the JTP goes hard. I love the show and everything, but there's some cool clones out there, some really funny people that, you know, would just rather not call and just rather tweet and, you know, sit behind their iPhones or whatever. But that's kind of what I do. But I had to get in on this, man. If you missed any of this epic tour, I know it's kind of been talked about. It's pretty much, you know, Kyle in Green Bay, it's pretty much a combination of Faces of Meth and Lord of the Rings. It's fairly entertaining, but I think most of us are just tuned in to see how long he can actually stretch this $1,200. He's been documenting all the stops. He's, you know, most notably tweeted this photo of him and Cal in Vegas. I heard some guy, you know, talking about that on the show right now. it's been getting a lot of run on JTP for sure. But my favorite thing about this Kyle in Green Bay epic, you know, whatever he's doing across the U.S. is this Periscope where Kyle's trying to explain to him, to Cal, how to shotgun a beer. And it has to be the most pathetic attempt ever. First off, Kyle preps Cal's beer for him like you would do for your wife or your girlfriend. You know, whatever you may think of Kyle, a lot of people, you know, think he's a bag or this or that. it's actually very sweet of him. It reminded me of all the times my five-year-old has needed some help getting that straw into her Capri Sun. Long story short, the video runs for another 30 seconds. Cal, I think he's probably taken about six attempts at this beer, pulls probably like five, six times on the can, still can't finish the beer. Pretty embarrassing, even for a guy that stopped growing in the fifth grade. Rome, honestly, I'm...
That's not a good call. No.
You don't like Reggie, honestly, not a very, you know, I let you go like 5 minutes longer than I should have. You know I was pulling for you. You know I gave you a lot of rope. You know that that entire JTP that you referenced was chanting, oat, oat, oat. The hell you doing, Rome? The hell you doing, Rome, if that were anybody else? Maybe. I mean, I gave you every opportunity to get to the end of the phone call. Mark, what's going on?
Hey, Jimbo, what's going on, man? Listen, I love Smack-Off season. I don't know what that sound that Geoff made before he asked Albie to put him out, but it sounded like his soul leaving his body. I mean, Drew the Jumpman Gillett feels bad for that dude right now. Anyway, listen, Jim, I heard a couple of days ago you said that there's a chance you could be putting up your own money for the Smack-Off this year. I have since relocated to Tampa. We have more strip clubs per capita than anywhere in the U.S., so small bills. I want small bills, please. And I love that profile you do with Caleb. When you hear some of his clips, that guy's got so much talent, so much game. Yes, he's going to win a Smack-Off one day. But also, did you know he's an accomplished poet and does the Golden Girls theme song at karaoke? So what's up, ladies? Hey, Jim, listen, I truly am rooting for Caleb. I mean, this guy needs a win badly. I mean, the best thing that's happened to this guy in, like, the last 2 years is when he got an extra nugget on his 10-piece from McDonald's. So, speaking of nuggets, it's called a transition clone. Look it up. Hey, Chris in Toronto, congratulations on your golden ticket. I do have some advice for you. Americans are fat, left of gimmicks, and Vic is boring. We got a couple of other Canadians that have been running with that angle for about 3 years now. And the most impactful thing they've ever done in the Smack-Off is show up on Brad and Corona's cash and prizes. So you might want to hit the lab a little bit before you come in here on game day. And, hey, Albie, get ready to put me out of my misery. I haven't seen a Lincoln get blasted that bad since John Wilkes Booth in the theater, am I right?
That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
Mark in Boston. Josh Jones joining us. Now, the thing about that is the journey is interesting in the sense that you worked with a number of offensive line coaches in your time at Houston, and there's a story that when Brandon Jones arrived there before your final year, he had it kind of in his head that you might be something of an underachiever. What do you remember about the arrival and your early days with him?
So when this staff came in, as you said, you know, this is my fourth, you know, around my fourth coaching staff. You know, I was thinking about transferring. You know, I was thinking about going to another school. So I wouldn't say I was, you know, I wouldn't say I was all in. You know, my head was like in different places at the time. You know, thinking about transferring. I actually entered the transfer portal, I think for like a couple of days. But then, you know, after going through the process, you know, talking with you know, different people like mentors, my family. And then with Dana and Coach Jones, man, I decided, you know, to come back and, you know, help those guys try to build a culture there. even more of a winning culture there, and finish where I started.
That's a really honest answer. I appreciate that. So you and Coach Jones have a conversation, and the two of you get real. It's a serious conversation. He said that he would help you maximize your potential, but that you had to meet him halfway. So what was that conversation like, and then what kind of an impact did that conversation have on you going forward?
That conversation, I come in, I think it's the beginning of the summer, I come in his office, and, we're talking about, me being a transporter, me going to different places. And then he just breaks it down to me. I tell him, I know the goals, I want, for myself. And I know you have the power to help me. I know you have the tools to help me. He stressed that. He was stressing that since he got there. And, he said, if you meet me halfway, I'm going to be here each and every day pushing you to be the best you can be, but you just got to come in every day with the mindset that you want to be, one of the best. So, from there, we just took off. Our relationship has, got way better. I talk to him almost every day, so I really thank him for that.
Josh Jones joining us. In addition to that, he told you something that I think is fascinating. I think that anybody listening right now, anybody who wants to improve at anything, I think would take something from this. He said to you, quote, you've got to make the extra that you were doing become your baseline, the bare minimum. You have to push yourself past that, and you have to do it each and every day. That to me is fascinating. Like, that's got to become your baseline, and you have to do it every single day. So how were you able to find that new level? And then how good did it feel to see it translate on the field and to dominate the way you started to dominate?
At first, it was a lot to take in.
Right.
Just changing your mindset, how you think, finding ways to make time for certain stuff. But then after a while, you find yourself deep into it. You find yourself loving the process. You find yourself loving the weight room, the extra time you stay in there. You love the extra time you stay in the film, the days you stay up late, watching film, man. You start to fall in love with that and the passion. And then as you get out there on the field, you see your body changing. You see, the results changing for you on the field and you being super successful. It pays off, but then you can't stop there. You just got to keep going, keep pushing yourself.
Dude, I think that's awesome. I think that's amazing. Like, how long did it take you, to get that new mindset, to make that your new normal? Was that a matter of weeks or months? How long does that take?
I feel like it kind of switched that day in his office when I came in there. I laid it all out to him, what I wanted to do and how I wanted to do it. It just kind of switched from there. He can probably tell you the same, that it was a different person from that day on.
No, he did say that. He says of you right now, quote, he's the best tackle I've had, and this will be my 12th year coaching Division I O-line. He just has it. So he went from saying, I need more from you, to you're the best he's ever had. So clearly you did what was expected. See, going to the draft, you have that huge year, and then there's a lot of talk about how you're going to go in the first round, but you didn't, and then you weren't picked in the second round either. What was that experience like?
Honestly, man, it was tough. It was tough just because, going into the draft, especially draft day, you get the information from your agent and, different sources that you're supposed to be, if not a first-round pick, you won last, 10, 15 picks into the second round. So that's just what we were expecting. My agent prepared me to go into the second. But after falling that low, man, the kind of pressure sits on you, how far am I going to fall? But ultimately, man, it ended up being good. I was able to get out there with the Arizona Cardinals with a great team. I'm just happy to be blessed, and I'm blessed to be able to be in this position. But it was tough, man. But it's all good now.
Josh Jones joining us. Again, that's a really honest response. That is hard. That's got to be hard. In the meantime, though, the Cards, it's hard for you and your family and those who care about you, but the Cards, man, they're pumped, and they're literally praying that you're still going to be there because they had you 21st ranked on their board overall. What's it like when you finally get that news and realize you're going to a program and a team like that?
Man, it was like, a weight lifted off your shoulders. All the work you've been putting in, in the draft process, all the team meetings, all the Zoom calls we were doing, it was just a big relief. And, I was happy for me. I was happy for my family. But this is only for the beginning for me.
So, Josh, what's your mindset now? I mean, you're going to be no matter what, you're going to be motivated because that's who you are. But when you go through something like that and you have teams pass on you, how much more motivated will you be? How much more driven will you be to make sure they all know they made a mistake?
Man, each and every time I step out on the field, I want to show people that, they were wrong, you know, for passing on me, you know, make them, you know, regret it. But, you know, that's just another chip on my shoulder. I'm still go out there and work hard, no matter that fact. But it's just another chip on my shoulder, another, you know, fuel to my fire for me to, you know, be the best player I can be.
Josh Jones joining me for a few more moments. And then it's always about fit. You're going to a team where Cliff Kingsbury is the coach. He recruited you out of high school. Brandon Jones was with him at Texas Tech. So how familiar are you with the scheme and the verbiage, and how helpful do you think that'll be?
So this past year, actually, we ran kind of a lot of the same stuff, you know, actually being able to look at the, you know, the playbook now. We actually ran a lot of the same stuff, so I'm not varying too much from what I was doing this past year in college. So, you know, I'm able to, you know, use those tools that I was able to use this past year to go out there and, you know, perform at a high level in for the Cardinals.
All right, so really quick, to that point, at Houston, you block for Greg Ward Jr. and De'Aaron King. What kind of thoughts do you have about blocking for Kyler Murray, and how much does that fire you up?
Man, it fires me up just because, you know, the type of player he is. You know, I've been blocking for, you know, kind of the same, you know, type of player with, like you said, Greg Ward and De'Aaron King. So I kind of know what to expect. But, you know, I'm just happy to get up there with, you know, just such a winner, you know, being from Texas and being – you know, being from Texas, he's like a legend down there. Just the stuff he did in, you know, in high school, even college, man. He just be able to play with such a great player. You know, I'm happy to be on the same field as him.
He was an all-conference player at Houston. He was the Outland Trophy watchlister. He allowed only one sack last season and ends up in a great spot. Josh Jones, my guest. Josh, I appreciate you, and I appreciate you coming on. Thanks so much for doing that, and I hope we can do it again during the season.
Yes, sir. No, thank you, Jim, for having me on. It was really fun, man. I appreciate it.
Good night now!